From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, three young podcasters in Milwaukee share what landed them in prison.
Then the Wisconsin winner of this year's Robert Frost Poetry Prize describes the unique challenges of writing rhymed poetry.
You've got to think creatively in order to reach that rhyme sound in a natural way. Rhyme is bad when it feels forced. And students can pick this out easily. They can tell when rhymes have been used just to fill out the rhyme scheme. That's part of the challenge, is not doing that.
Outdoor Adventures writer Stacy Tornio and her son Jack speak in praise of the summer bucket list.
And cheese contributor Jeanette Hurt brings along a cheddar that was born from the best of everything.
What they did is they took characteristics of worldwide cheddars from Australia, New Zealand, some other things. It's just a lovely, eatable, edible, and noshable cheese.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Over the past few years, we've done stories about juvenile justice reform in Wisconsin in the wake of scandals involving the state's Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. But the people we're about to hear from have a perspective we don't often get to hear. They are Milwaukee area students who were finalists in this year's NPR Student Podcast Challenge.
The audio storytelling competition drew hundreds of entries from around the country, but this group of Milwaukee teens stood out. At the time they recorded the podcast, they were incarcerated at the Vel R. Phillips Juvenile Justice Center. The teenagers go by the pseudonyms JT, JC, and Joe, and they were serving sentences in the Milwaukee County Accountability Program, or MCAP. It's a close-to-home alternative to the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison.
With help from their teachers, the students decided to use the NPR competition to tell the stories of how they ended up behind bars. Here is their podcast called The VRP Breakdown.
We are currently at the Vel R. Phillips School. My name is JT. I'm 15 years old.
My name is JC. I'm 16 years old.
My name's Joe. I was born September 19th. I'm 16 years old.
This project is about, you know, us getting together, doing this podcast, just to tell our stories. Although we're in juvenile detention, we're still good kids, and, you know, we just made mistakes. We are in the MCAP program. MCAP stands for Milwaukee County Accountability Program. Basically, we were sent to the MCAP programs to change our patterns of thinking. We get programs to help us better ourselves, like JCIP. For those who don't know what that is, that's Juvenile Cognitive Intervention Program, to help us alter our thinking. We get groups like Express Yourself.
Restorative Justice.
Restorative Justice. IOTA Treatment. Well, now we are going to tell our stories, you know, us three inmates, JT, JC, and Joe. I'll be starting. Well, my name is JT. I'm 15 years old, like I said earlier. My story's a little complicated. I mean, it all started just wanting a little money, you know, being around the wrong crowd, doing the wrong things. I'll be 16 this year, but I'll say about 13 is when I really, like, starting to get into the street, you know, walking around my neighborhood and seeing the so-called, the big homies, you know, just having the foreign cars, you know, the Infiniti trucks, the Lexuses, the Benzes, seeing them with all this money, you know, the jewelry, the phones around their neck, you know, gold teeth. It was just idolizing, you know what I'm saying? My dad was in my life, but you know what I'm saying? Just to be like them, you know, I was young. I was just wanting to be a follower, you know. But that's how I guess I got into it. Well, when I was 13, that's when I first learned, you know, about, like, stealing cars. That's when I first learned how to hustle. My guy, he just told me about the streets and just showed me all the easy money that's really out here. And as a 13-year-old, I mean, well, he, like, probably 30, pushing 30 at least. As a 13-year-old, a grown man, just, if a grown man show you a grown man that you look up to, if a grown man show you how to get some money, you gonna wanna follow him. You know what I'm saying? He a grown man, he know what he talking about. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, he taught me how to hustle. And by hustle, I mean, you know, selling dope or whatever. It was easy little money. You know, I wasn't really making nothing. I mean, probably like $100, $200 a week. I mean, it wasn't really nothing. I probably could have been making more than that at a job. But, I mean, me being 13, that's a pair of shoes a week. You know what I'm saying? That's some, I don't know. But after that, I started hanging with a different group of people who taught me how to steal cars. I mean, if you mixed that with the drug thing, I mean, who not? You got you a free car, and you got some money that's coming in your pocket from, you know, the hustling part. You know, that's when I really started getting in trouble. I got caught in a couple cars. The fact that I was still making money, you know what I'm saying? Like, being around, I mean, it was negative influence, but just being around people who wasn't getting caught. I didn't got caught. My first time getting caught, I was 14, so I was doing it for about a year. But still just like, just doing it over and over, it become like a part of your life, like this is what you used to. And I was an A student, ABC student. I always had good grades. I was accepted into go to my year high school. That's one of the top ones in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the streets just was calling me, and I done lost opportunities from it. And you know, just that calling coming to you, it just, I don't know, it's like a rush of excitement, just doing the same thing. It'll lead you to just bad situations. And that's really why I'm here, where I'm at today.
My name JC. Like my guy said, JT, you know, just growing up in a certain part of, like, just, you know, just growing up in a neighborhood, the hood, that's what they call it, you know. Growing up in the wrong neighborhood with people that steal cars, deal drugs, and just, you know, do all types of illegal stuff and stuff like that. And you know, like he said, you young. Like my guy said, I start off at 13, young age, seeing people with money, seeing people riding in cars, seeing people that's, you know, like, or what you think, famous, you know, like you want to be like them. You want to have clout, you know, you want to have fame, you want to have all that. You just want a name, really. So people start getting out here, start hanging with the, you know, certain people to start getting certain things and to start getting a name and to start doing certain stuff. So I ain't really grew up with no father figure, you know. Or I can't say that because I really know he was in my life when I was, like, younger. But, you know, growing up and stuff, at like, growing up at, like, the age, just growing up at, like, 9, he came back into my life. Nah, like 10, he came back into my life. He just came out of nowhere. And my mom said, this is my dad. I started talking to him. My birthday in September 6th, you know, Christmas a couple months after that. So, you know, he came into my life just out of nowhere. He started just telling me stuff, starting how he sorry, how he was trying to turn his life around and stuff from doing drugs and stuff. He didn't really do drugs. He's like a alcohol, like, you know, he like just somebody like that. Yeah. And like, he just came out of nowhere and tried to tell me he's sorry, trying to turn his life around and stuff. He started promising me stuff for my birthday. It was like 2 weeks before my birthday. He was trying to promise stuff for my birthday. Ooh, because I used to be a person like that, play games all day. I used to just sit in the house, play the Xbox, and just sit there, really. But then he started promising, like, ooh, I'm going to get you this. I'm going to get you that. I got you this for Christmas. After that, I ain't never seen him after that. But I don't know. He just came in. He came. We just left. And I ain't never really seen him after that. Except for, like, I ain't going to lie, since, like, last July 4th, I seen him. He started texting me on Facebook and stuff. Or he started texting my mama, really, and my mama told me, and I started texting him. I'm like, all right, bet. Ain't nothing wrong with getting nobody a chance or whatever. So I started talking to him. He said he was coming from somewhere, I don't know, a different country. He said he was coming from somewhere else to come see me for July 4th or whatever. He came the day before July 4th, July 3rd, he came. I think that was, I don't know what day that was, but he came. He just pulled up with his mama, I think. He came, He started talking to me and stuff. He talking to me, doing the same thing, telling me he gonna do this, telling me he gonna do that. We gonna go get some shoes. I got you with this. I got you with that. After that, I ain't never seen him. He said he'll be right back, or he said he'll see me later. I ain't seen him that day. Next day, July 4th, I seen him. Or I ain't seen him, but, you know, it's nighttime. You know, people start popping firecrackers nighttime. I go over to my brother's house. He live on the south side. I go over there. He's sitting over there and stuff. He's sitting over there with my brother and him. So I go over there. I see him. I ain't saying nothing to him at all. He over there drinking, getting drunk or whatever, just sitting there. I ain't saying nothing to him. He ain't saying nothing to me. After that, I ain't seen him. It's today. I ain't never seen him after that. Still to this day, I don't know. But if he try to talk to me, I don't think I'll let him, you know, get back close to me, you know, because I let him get that close to me and he ain't doing nothing but the same stuff. So ain't no point to try to, you know, give people a chance and they're going to keep on doing the same thing.
My name is Joe. Like JC said, started stealing cars at 13. I had some teenage cousins who told me how to do it. After that, I just started robbing people for their cars, hopping in cars that I saw running, selling them. My mindset was like, I'd never get caught.
Yeah.
Until I got caught. Then came the MCAP. Smoking weed mainly got me stealing cars. The person who got me smoking weed is my uncle. But my uncle, he was like 16 to 17 at the time, so he wasn't really grown. The reason I was stealing cars is mainly to hide girls in there and to think I'm the best driver around Milwaukee.
Yeah. That's common.
Yeah.
That's common.
I always had my daddy in my life, but...
Lucky.
He always did stupid stuff to get locked up. He always bought me stuff. He never actually lied to me, but he always just did stupid stuff to get locked up.
Also, I would like to add that I would, whenever I get out of here, or if a young person listening to this right now, try to take our mistakes and our stories and just try to use them, you know, because we not the only ones that go through this. It's another 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 12, 11, 10. It's another kid out there right now that's going through the same stuff that we done been through. And that's going to end up in the same shoes that we in. Somebody going to fill these MCAP shoes eventually. It's sad to say. But try to just take our stories and run with them. Like, I don't wanna be an MCAP. No. Thanks for listening. Love and joy.
Those were students JT, JC, and Joe. They were incarcerated at the Velar Phillips Juvenile Justice Center in Wauwatosa. Their podcast was a finalist in the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. It was produced with help from teachers Krishana Robinson and Dave Medazian.
To hear more from the students and the teachers, you can check out WUWM education reporter Emily Files' story at our website, wuwm.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll meet the UWM professor who won this year's International Frost Farm Prize for Metrical Poetry. We'll be back to talk about it and to hear the poem when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Robert Frost is one of the United States' best-known poets and one of our most decorated. Frost won 4 Pulitzer Prizes for poetry. He received 31 Nobel Prize nominations and a Congressional Gold Medal, and he was Vermont's first poet laureate.
Frost's works, from The Road Not Taken to Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, are full of nature, solitude, and existential questioning. And often those poems were rhymed.
Our next guest, David Southward, has won the 2019 International Frost Farm Prize for Metrical Poetry, which honors work written in rhyme. As you might guess, it's a lot harder than it seems. Southward teaches in UWM's Honors College, and he joined me in the studio recently. David Southward, it is such a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on winning the Frost Prize. That's a big deal.
It's huge. Frost is my very favorite poet, so I was just overjoyed to get the news. And to be able to read in his home space is just really a thrill, so it's exciting.
Well, before we get to the poem itself and how you came to send in a poem for this, let's back up a little bit and talk about your interest in writing poetry in the first place. I mean, you haven't been doing it all that long.
Now, I started really getting serious in my 40s, so it's never too late. I always thought of myself as a writer, but I thought I would be a fiction writer. And I tried that for a while, but it's really hard when you're teaching full-time to create the headspace that you need for fiction to kind of stay immersed in a fantasy world. And at a certain point, I just had a realization that I was meant to be a poet. Partly it was the practicality of my job, but really it was more that I'm such a wordsmith. I'm so finicky about the sound of words. And that's one reason I couldn't write fiction is because I would get stuck on style. And that would kind of impede the progress of the narrative.
So when you were either reading poetry or starting to write it yourself, what were the kinds of poets and the types of poems that you were attracted to?
Well, I love Frost's work. I like metrical poetry. I like musical poetry. So, you know, the English Romantics and obviously Shakespeare. I really love Emily Dickinson, Yeats. In terms of modern poetry, I like the musicality of T.S. Eliot. But in general, I would say I'm not as excited by modern poetry as I am by the older poets.
Right. You talk about metrical poetry, and that is where things have, each line has a specific number of beats.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to describe it, I think, more so than the old-fashioned use of feet, the iambic and trochaic and anapestic, because I think it's really more about hearing the pattern of stresses as a beat, because you don't want it to be too rigid. You just want there to be this sense of a rhythm that's kind of fluid and that you can vary, but that's steady enough that it's perceptible.
Is metrical poetry often rhymed or not, or does it not matter?
It can be both.
Okay.
When it's unrhymed, usually it's blank verse. That's what Shakespeare mostly wrote in. So it's iambic pentameter, but without rhyme. But it can be rhymed too. And I suppose I probably use rhyme more often than I don't. But I do.
I would think that would be harder because rhyme, particularly now with so much deconstructed poetry out there, rhyme can feel precious if you don't do it right.
That's true. But that's part of the challenge. And that's what I actually have my students write in rhyme. And many of them just have never tried it or never thought to try it for that very reason, because it sounds kind of childish. But what they find is that it opens up a new door in their imagination. The thing about rhyme is it leads you to ideas that you wouldn't have had unless you were seeking out the rhyme. And so it actually is like a path to new thoughts and conceptions that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
As opposed to it being restrictive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's an interesting way to think about it, because the actual structure forces you to open up even more.
Yes. How do I get from A to B,
mm-hmm.
you know, or from A to B to B to A? You know, you've got to think creatively in order to reach that rhyme sound in a natural way. Rhyme is bad when it feels forced. And students can pick this out easily. They can tell when rhymes have been used just to fill out the rhyme scheme. But that's part of the challenge, is not doing that.
When you are thinking about a poem, does the subject matter dictate how you approach it, or do you play with it and see where it fits?
It's a little bit of both. It's like trying to wield a divining rod. You know, it's like with the poem that I won the contest with, I sort of had a feeling that a sestina was going to be a good form for that poem because it has a complex series of repetitions, and I thought that that would create the sort of haunting effect that I wanted for that poem. But sometimes you get halfway through a poem and you just get stuck and you realize this isn't working. And so you have to let it go, or you have to find a different form. So it's organic, I guess. It's always different for every poem.
So for someone who is thinking about writing poetry and has no formal training, is it important to know what is going on? Like you just mentioned sestina. You know, I don't even know what that exact structure is. Could I accidentally write that and not know that I've done it?
You could never accidentally write a sestina. Good luck.
It's one of those that you must know what it is.
It's it's probably the most rigid form that I know, because it's where you use the same six end words throughout the poem. So every stanza is six lines, and the six words that you end the first stanza's lines with, you end every subsequent stanza with, but kind of like in a cycling order so that they keep moving around, but in a way that you can't determine arbitrarily. It's sort of determined by the rules of the form.
Ah.
So it's extremely rigid, which is why, you know, people don't write them that often.
Well, we're going to hear it in just a moment. But getting back to the initial question that I had, when people are first starting out and they think they might have the poetic bug and they might want to explore their world through that form, what do you suggest? I mean, should they have formal training, or can somebody start writing poetry not really knowing what they're doing and then learn from there?
I don't think you need the formal training. I think all good poetry comes from the heart. Yes, it does take some training. I think if you want to write in meter, there are some things that you need to know, but you can sort of teach yourself some of those things. I think just reading carefully a poet that you love, you learn so much from. And often, you know, for instance, students will write in meter without even realizing they're doing it, because some of these meters are very deeply ingrained in our cultural imagination, you know, like ballad meter or hymn meter, those really strong four-beat lines that, you know, that are everywhere in our popular music. Students can write in that just naturally, effortlessly. So we've all got that inside us just by virtue of speaking our language and listening to the songs that we do. Formal training will help. I think if you want to write in more complex forms, in iambic pentameter specifically, five beats per line is a little trickier. It doesn't come quite as automatically because it's easy to kind of crash the meter if you don't place those stresses just right. But there are books. There are plenty of books out there on, you know, writing in meter. Something like Tim Steele has a book called All the Funds and How You Say a Thing. And that's a really wonderful introduction to meter.
Let's talk about the poem that you won the Frost Prize for. We mentioned it's a sestina.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking in writing this poem? Were you writing it for the prize, or were you writing it for something else?
Oh, no, this was written long before the prize. And in fact, I submitted this to several journals. It was rejected before it ever won the prize. So that's another lesson. Just keep sending your stuff out there. Somebody's going to like it. No, this poem, it grew out of an experience that it's about a true event. Something that I knew I wanted to write about as soon as it happened, but I wasn't sure at first what form it was going to take. And I had actually never written a sestina. And I kind of in the back of my mind was thinking, I need to do that at some point. It's just this milestone that I have to pass. And I soon realized that this seemed like a very fitting form for the subject matter and for the kind of feeling that it left me with. And so that's where the poem began.
Okay. So can we hear it?
Absolutely. Mary's Visit. We watched her car pass slowly by our house and circle back with purpose. It appeared she'd spotted us, nestled in our dream of a stone cottage from an earlier time. She parked out front and asked to come inside. Naturally, we concluded she was lost or peddling religion. All she had lost, however, was certainty. Could this house have been her great-aunt Gertrude's? Look inside if you want, we told her. Something might appear to bring back vanished memories of the time she played here with her siblings. I've had dreams, she said, of finding it again. One dream in which the porch was sloped like ours. Half lost in the wistful currents pulling her through time, I pictured the aunt living in our house, and how, whenever relatives appeared on the doorstep, she'd hold the pain inside her knotted joints and smile. Here inside our damp, shade-darkened rooms, her niece would dream that Gertrude was a witch, that ghosts appeared behind the bathtub curtain, and that lost in the woods out back of the spinster's house were her missing children. This stored-up time had become a burden to our guest, a time that had no place. It rattled around inside, where doubts began to creep. Although our house looked like the one she'd come to in her dream, its lines were off. The floor plan did not match a pattern that had all but disappeared. Maybe, she tapped her head, it's all up here. One's memories grew entangled over time with longing, hope, regret. The thread soon lost that leads out of the maze we live inside, bumping against the glass doors of our dreams in search of some distinct, authentic house. Her fear appeared to change the mood inside as time resumed its course. Clutching her dream of what she'd lost, Mary left our house.
Wow. That is just really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was David Southward reading his poem, Mary's Visit. You know, I was trying to hear the sestina, the six, and I kind of felt it more than I heard it.
That's good. That's what I want. Because if you're too focused on the form and too aware of it, it means you're not really hearing the poem.
Beautiful imagery and just lovely stuff. I mean, I was obviously never been to that house, but I was there. And that's kind of what I ask poems to do, is to take me somewhere.
I agree, to transport you.
Yeah. So now that you've won the prize, what is the next step? Are they going to have you
Yes, read it? I'm invited as the featured reader. It's going to be June 14th. It's the Father's Day weekend. And it's during a conference that they have there, so there will be courses and guest speakers. But I'll be the featured reader on Friday night.
How exciting.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty thrilling.
And will it be published?
It's technically considered published, I think, because it's on the website.
Okay.
And they asked if they could do that, and I said certainly. It's an honor for me. So, online publication is pretty much equivalent now to print publication. That old distinction between them is sort of fading away. So it's kind of considered published.
Terrific. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for coming in and telling us about this. Again, congratulations. It's a great honor. And it's a great honor to have you here in Milwaukee and here in the studio.
And I feel the same way. I've been a big fan of the show for a long time. So thank you.
David Southward is a senior lecturer in the Honors College at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the winner of the 2019 International Frost Farm Prize for Metrical Poetry. He's in New Hampshire this week to collect his prize and will read his winning poem, Mary's Visit. There is more information at WUWM.com.
School's out, and what do we do to keep the kids from climbing the walls? Well, we'll have some suggestions when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. As Alice Cooper once sang, school's out for summer. Many kids in the Milwaukee area are done, and the rest will be soon, which means that for a lot of kids, we're just a few short days away from the point where they complain about being bored.
But there is a cure for that affliction, and it comes through the advice of writer Stacy Tornio and the co-author of her new book, Jack Tornio, who happens to be Stacy's 15-year-old son. Their book is called 101 Outdoor Adventures to Have Before You Grow Up. They're going to share suggestions from time to time throughout the summer, starting with today's show. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Yep.
We're going to have you join us a handful of times over the summer to talk about some adventures that you can have that are kind of an outgrowth of the book that the two of you co-authored. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about how this book evolved. Stacy, you've been sort of a longtime nature writer, but how did the collaboration with your son happen?
Last spring, we were talking about how most kids' books are written by adults, which of course they are. But we were like, wouldn't it be cool if a book actually had a kid's perspective? And so I asked Jack, I'm like, what do you think of the idea of giving that kid's perspective? And I really didn't know what he was going to say. And he like jumped at the chance.
Yeah, I really did. I thought it was a cool experience, so I could like tell about all my outdoor adventures that I've done and talk about new ones that I will end up doing in the near future.
So you have been like kind of an outdoors guy your whole life, right?
Yeah, I've gotten poison ivy a lot of times to prove it.
Is that actually in the book? Do you recommend doing that at least once while you're growing up?
I don't think you can really have that outdoors experience unless you actually like experience like a consequence of the outdoors, if you know what I'm saying.
But we do recommend learning how to identify poison ivy.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, so that you can avoid it.
How do you think a kid's perspective, either of you, a kid's perspective differs from an adult perspective when it comes to talking about these kinds of adventures?
I really feel like kids can really understand that. And, like, as a teenager, I can really understand what kids are going through and, like, can really talk to them and appeal to their, like, fun and creative sides to motivate them to go outside.
Now I know she's sitting across the console from you. Are there things that she wants to do that you just roll your eyes at that you tried to avoid in the book?
You know what? It might be the other way around.
Oh, really?
It really is.
Because Jack is, like, so adventurous that he's up for anything. And it's, like, it's notoriously known among my close family and friends that I don't love camping. Like, I don't love tent camping and being on the ground.
I'm laughing only because I'm about to go to Door County, and I'm going to sheepishly admit that the rest of my family is tent camping, and I am staying a couple miles away in a hotel.
See? That would be me. And so Jack is, like, let's do this, let's do that. And sometimes I have to, like, okay, I'm not quite ready. Or, like, he pushes me in ways that are really, really wonderful.
So we're going to, over the course of the summer, talk about a handful of ideas. But let's talk about a big picture idea, and that is the summer bucket list. I think we know what a bucket list is, but what goes into making a good summer bucket list?
Everybody gets input. And so it's like, make a list of your 3 to 5 things that you want to do. And they can be places you want to go. They can be just things you want to do. Like, I want to make jam, or I want to make fresh salsa. And so they can really be anything. And then we try to combine them all together and narrow down on a few so we can, like, start putting it on the calendar.
So you just suggested a few things. Have you already made a summer bucket list as we're having this conversation today?
Sometimes, but, like, I've kind of made, like, an overall bucket list in general. Like, it's been, like...
Like a life's bucket list?
Yeah, like, I've gone to the Grand Canyon before to, like, view it, but it's always been, like, a dream of mine to actually hike the whole Grand Canyon and go all the way down and all the way back up, and I feel like that would be a really fun experience for me.
One of the other things I notice, I forget which adventure it is, but it's actually a point that you made, which is to cut yourself some slack. I think it was learn how to set up a tent, but to cut yourself some slack if you don't get it right away. And I would imagine that even an ambitious bucket list, you might have to just concede you're not going to get to everything on it.
Yeah, and I mean, one example of that is, like, biking, and that's one that Jack is, he's like, wants to start biking places, and he's 15, and it's like, well, yeah, we could bike to the farmer's market. There's a lot of, like, beer gardens or concerts happening, and so that can start really small, of, like, biking to the local park and then taking it a little bit more and a little bit further each time.
Let me ask a dumb question. Do you have the bucket list printed out someplace? Do you have it on an app on your phone? How do you kind of hold yourself to it?
We use a calendar, or we're right in the middle of making ours. So, like, everyone has been tasked with the idea of come up with some ideas. And then we will use a physical calendar. Like, you can just print one off, and we will start to put things on the calendar.
Well, I know you said, Jack, that you've kind of have one for your whole life. But is there one thing that, as we're talking at the beginning of June, you want to make sure you do this summer?
I like to go outdoors a lot, as we all know. And, like, I go up north a lot at my grandma's cabin, so I just like to do new things there. Like, I haven't hiked or, like, biked a mountain trail there in, like, a really long time, like 4 or 5 years. So maybe get back to that this summer at some point during the year. At least if it's not, like, the biggest bike ride, maybe, like, a 1 mile, like, bike all around the trail.
I imagine one of the tricks is when you're compiling a bucket list as a whole family, you have to be kind of mindful of the different ages and abilities that everybody has.
Yeah, and that's why, like, you really need to take turns and kind of do something that everybody wants to do. Like, Wisconsin is great in the summer, and so, like, Cave of the Mounds, I've never been there. And, like, actually I've talked to several people, and they're like, oh, yeah, I've kind of heard of that, and I've never been. And so, like, that's something on my list. And, like, what a great time to go into a cave, which is cooler than in the summer, you know? So there's so much to do within driving distance, even in Milwaukee, that you can really make it a whole family event.
Driving distance, or maybe biking distance.
Right. Okay. Great.
Well, Stacy and Jack Tornio, thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yep, thanks.
Contributor Stacy Tornio is the author of several books about nature, including her latest, co-authored by her son, Jack. It's called 101 Outdoor Adventures to Have Before You Grow Up.
One last break, and then, because no summer would be complete without cheese, Jeanette Hurt joins us to share her latest way cool suggestion. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. For those of you who have not picked up on this news, Mitch is pulling up stakes and he's moving to upstate New York. We're recording his last show with Lake Effect next Wednesday evening on site at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. You are welcome to come, and you can find out more information about how to register at WUWM.com.
Shameless self-promotion done with. I am going to miss a lot about Wisconsin when I leave, and that includes cheese. But I do have this recollection that New York also has a pretty impressive dairy industry, so who better to give me some advice than cheese contributor Jeanette Hurt, cheese and cocktail writer and Lake Effect contributor. Welcome back to the show.
And it's wonderful to see you as well, Mitch.
There is already cheese on the console in front of us.
Yes.
But before we get to what you have brought for us today and what we're going to try, what's new in the cheese world that we ought to know about?
Well, there's several interesting things. Over Memorial Day weekend, I went to the second annual The Big Cheese event at Elkhart Lake, which is phenomenal if you like cheese. It is the only place I know that hosts an annual cheesemaker's dinner. There's plenty of winemaker's dinners out there where the winemakers are celebrated, but this is one where the executive chef and his entire team works with the cheesemakers that give their cheese for the event, and there were nine cheese courses.
And Nine cheese courses.
Yes. And they were amazing. There were things like there was a dessert, a brownie with a Parmesan on top that was actually wonderful. Of course, there was an apple with cheddar. There were fondutas with goat cheese, and there were potato galettes with layers of cheddar. Mm. And I got to sit across from Josh Henning, who is the nephew of Carrie Henning of Henning's Cheese.
Okay.
And he, I believe, is going to be the fifth generation cheesemaker. He and his cousins and siblings are taking, will eventually take over the plant. And he was talking about working to develop cheese profiles and how when you test a cheese recipe, it's not like when you brew a beer recipe and you can tell right away, or if you make bread and say, hey, this works, you have to wait a few months. It's like making wine or aged spirits. It's something that can take months or years, and then you figure out, oh, this didn't taste so good. So you go back to the drawing board.
Right. This is the thing that always amazes me about the master cheesemakers out there. They have to be so sure or so convinced of a recipe that they have to be willing to give it a year or 2 years or 3 years or 15 years before they know whether it's worked.
And they can kind of tell. When I've interviewed Tony Hooks of Hooks Cheese, and he's the guy who ages cheddars out 20 years. He and his wife, Julie, are amazing, and they do wonderful things. But when I talk to him, he's like, I get certain cheeses for certain milks from certain farms for certain cheeses. And he says, I can just tell after I make it, which I think is pretty amazing because why does this cheddar age well and why is this one only a few months? Now, that was also interesting talking with Josh Henning at the dinner because he was really – outside of being real, he and his wife are charming and funny and interesting, is he's someone who is going through the process of studying and working to get his master cheesemaker's license. He's already a licensed cheesemaker, and as you know, in Wisconsin, we have the most rigorous system for just licensing cheese. You have to work under a year or two just to get your license before you're allowed to make your own cheese. Whereas other states, you know, you can take a 24-hour weekend class and you can set up shop. Not in Wisconsin. And that goes back because you asked me to talk about New York cheese.
Yes. Yeah, so
since you're moving.
Very self-interested question here. I'll be moving to upstate New York in just a few short weeks' time. And New York, another dairy state, lots of dairy cows, especially up in the part where I'll be living. But I know nothing about the cheese tradition there.
Well, it predates Wisconsin. In fact, one of the reasons Wisconsin became such a good cheese and dairy state is because of the regulations they had to develop. Wisconsin initially was a wheat state, but bugs and blight ruined those crops. We tried hops. Worked for the breweries, but it didn't, in terms of catching on and really becoming something. It wasn't until we had primarily Swiss immigrants and then New York dairy farmers who moved out west. And they brought their techniques and they brought their traditions and they figured, hey, we have the right water, we have the right climate for grass, and again, as I've said before, the ideal temperature for happy cows is somewhere between 40 and 50 degrees. And lately, as spring and summer hasn't really totally happened.
It's been a great cheese spring or summer.
Yes, the cows like it. Us, maybe not so much. But so when we started making cheese, though, our brokers would go down to Chicago and they'd try to sell cheese and they would say, well, why do we want cheese from Sheboygan? We want quality of New York cheese. New York was the epitome. In fact, the very first cheese factory was invented by a guy named Jesse Williams in upstate New York in 1851. Wisconsin didn't really start getting into the dairying until posts. I mean, we had people making cheese from the 1840s and stuff, but it didn't really start becoming an industry until the 1870s and 80s when we had Cheesemakers Association and a Dairymen's Association form. And then we, at the University of Wisconsin, developed an agriculture college, which was devoted to dairying. And then we had laws that were set that were very stringent in order to compete with New York. So to be able to say, well, we have high quality because we set these standards, it was to compete with New York. And then, of course, we continued to grow. And by the 1920s, we were America's Dairyland, et cetera.
So we really took the upstate New York tradition and ran with it.
Yes, we did. Today, New York still makes cheese. They are the largest producer of yogurt. I think one of that reasons is because Faggy, I think, is located there. And the other thing, they are the fourth largest milk producer. Maybe 5 years ago, they were the third largest, but I think some other states have edged them. That said, dairy farming is the number one agricultural industry in the state of New York. Now, farmers make only 1% of New York State's population, but in terms of agriculture, it is their agriculture. And they don't just, like Wisconsin, they don't just do cow dairy farming. They do goat. They do sheep's milk. I believe the brand is Hudson Valley Camembert. There's some amazing Blumy Rind cheeses that are just to die for. And they also make some really lovely cheddars, especially sharp cheddars. But speaking of cheddars and awards, one of the cheeses I tasted when I was at the Osthoff at the Big Cheese, which is held Memorial Day weekend, and it's an event going forward. So if you're a cheese lover and you want to meet cheesemakers or attend a class like a cheese and cocktail pairing, which I did, or cheese and cider or cheese and wine or cheese and whiskey or cheese and tea, or a cheese-making class itself or cheese cooking classes, they'll have them that weekend. So anyway, one of the interesting cheese-making companies here in Wisconsin is Deer Creek. And Deer Creek has won a lot of awards, but they don't actually have a cheese plant. What they do is they work with master cheesemakers and cheese-making companies like Henning's, like Carr Valley, to come up with these amazing recipes that they brainstorm with. Their owner works with the owners of these other cheese-making companies. And one of these is their Vat 17, which is a naturally aged cheddar. And what they did is they took characteristics of worldwide cheddars from Australia, New Zealand. I think they might have included New York. I'm not sure. But some other things. It's just a lovely, eatable, edible, and noshable cheese. And it's warm, it's nutty, it's delicious. So I thought I'd bring some for you.
I'm going to grab a big hunk of it there. It's a light color. For people who are used to the orangey-looking cheddars, this is a white cheddar.
It's a white cheddar. It's aged, but it's not super aged. If you notice, it's crumbly, but It doesn't have the crystals in it.
Absolutely. I have to say, and as we've noted earlier in this interview, this is the last chance the two of us will have to talk on the air. Hopefully not the last chance we will have to talk, but I feel as though I am a far more sophisticated cheese consumer in the years that we have been talking than I was beforehand. And
I'm so glad.
This cheddar is melting in my mouth.
It melts, and it makes you want to go back for another piece, doesn't it?
It
it's
absolutely
just yummy.
Does.
It would be really good.
I can see why your husband has been noshing on.
Yes. It's one of those cheeses where you could just continue to snack on it with some apples or some bread, mm-hmm. or you could throw it in a mac and cheese or a cheese sauce, or throw it on some bread and melt it for a grilled cheese sandwich, maybe with some fresh tomatoes this summer.
And you were describing this, and the idea here is they've taken the cheddar traditions from
other regions of the world, and what they probably – they didn't say in their little speech at the dinner, but what I think they meant is they probably took some different bacterial cultures, because every cheese has certain bacterial cultures that make it the kind of cheese it is. And I would guess they probably said, well, what are the exact cheddar cultures that they use for Australian or New Zealand cheddar or New York cheddar versus Wisconsin cheddar? And I know they use some Wisconsin cheddar aspects, but it's a little bit different.
Crazy not to.
Yes. But it's just a lovely, interesting cheese, and it's a little bit different. And what they do is they work with other cheesemakers to make this cheese to their specifications. They do some interesting flavored cheeses. One of my favorites for cocktail pairing is their Blue Jay, which contains juniper berries.
Oh, wow.
So if you're going to have a martini with blue cheese stuffed olive, stuff your olives yourself with the Blue Jay cheese. Or you can use it, as I did, with a gin Cosmo, and you put a little hunk of cheese between two dried cranberries and throw it in.
Now, is cheese going to find its way into your cocktail book in some way?
Of course it is. In fact, this week on Tuesday, I was up at Larry's Market because I was speaking at the Cudahy Library about the history of cheese. And every time I go to Larry's, or any cheese store for that matter, if they allow samples, which they do at Larry's, I always try to see, well, what's new? And one of the things I tried there is they have a cognac-rubbed Bellavitano. Mm. And I think that would pair perfectly with an old-fashioned.
I feel like I need another piece of this.
I think you need
cheddar.
To have a few more pieces. It's fun to snack on. But it's not overpowering.
No, but it has a nice cheddar taste to it. Yeah, there's nothing I don't like about this cheese, except that there is not more of it.
Well, I'll slice a few more slices before I leave, so then you can have it for a snack later. I think in terms of the cheese horizon, one thing that has been interesting to me is to see within the past year, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board rebranded as the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin. And I think that's one thing to emphasize, the farm-to-table, the local movement, because they really represent the dairy farmers is who they represent. But it's an interesting thing, what I have seen. And in the time since I wrote my first cheese book to now, I write about cheese, but I also write about spirits and wine and beer and cider, as my cider book is coming out at the end of the summer. But it's interesting to me because I have a background in cheese, and cheese has so many complex flavor compounds. It can pair with almost any beverage. Cider is one of those things that I've learned with my cider book. Almost any cider pairs with almost any cheese because it's effervescent. And what do you put on a cheese plate but apples?
Right.
So there's some really interesting things out there. We're meeting before the American Cheese Society's annual conference, and usually Wisconsin cleans up. Even if they don't win the best in show or first or second runner-up, they usually win several categories. And that's one thing that's interesting. But I think what you'll be doing when you're in New York, you'll be watching the New York Cheese, and there's a New York Cheesemakers Association, and there's some artisan cheesemakers associations in New York. And what I would recommend is where you're located is going to be in the heart of cheese country in New York is to go and see which ones accept visitors to visit them, especially if there are farmstead creameries. Not that other artisan creameries aren't wonderful, but when they're farmstead, you actually get to see the animals. And it's always fun to pet baby cows or baby lambs. And I will say, if you go with a notebook, the goats will try to eat it, because that has happened to me every time I visited goats.
So I'm writing down, buy goat-proof notebook.
Yes, there you go.
Well, I was going through my old files to clean out my file cabinets as I get ready to depart for the North Country, and I ran across the file folder for the first interview we did with you, and I was reminded that we found you because you had written an article about the history of Wisconsin cheese for the Midwest Airlines In-Flight magazine.
Yes.
And I'm so glad I took that flight because you've been with us ever since. And
it's been fun to be here. And it was always fun for me as a writer based here in Wisconsin, because their In-Flight magazine, from the time I wrote for them, the editors were first in California, and then my editors were in New York City, and they needed someone here down on the ground in Wisconsin. So that was a fun story to write. And it hasn't, things have only improved. They haven't really changed. We still are number one in cheese production. We still make more than 1,000 different types of cheese. And dairy isn't just our number one agricultural enterprise. It's our number one industry. And I think that's something people need to respect and understand. And I think right now, with different things like the tariffs going on, there are some of our farmers who are really struggling. And that's one of those things. So try to buy, and you can buy local cheese in just about in every grocery store here in Wisconsin.
Well, we may be number one in cheese curds and number one in cheese. You are number one in cheese conversation. Jeanette Hurt, it has been a pleasure over all these years.
It has been a pleasure as well, Mitch.
Jeanette Hurt is the author of books on cheese and cocktails, including The Cheeses of Wisconsin, Drink Like a Woman, and her next book, The Joy of Cider. You can listen back to our previous conversations with her at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.